Good evening.
Good evening.
I thought I'd talk tonight about the state of working with our lives in the presence of unease. And it may be political unease, it may be health oriented unease or environment, or at the personal and community level, at the global level. It seems to be quite present for many these days. I didn't expect to do what I'm about to do, but I'm going to do it anyway. Did you know that you're sitting in a forest? This looks completely like a building, and it's a forest. I'll give you a tour. The what we call the meal board, the top of the platform and the front of the platform that you're sitting on, are made of fir trees. In the body of the platform, this is birch. The altar is made of Monterey pine, made by a fellow named Jim Abrams, who used to live next door, and designed by Paul Disco, the main architect of San Francisco Zen Center. And I understand that the wood of that altar came from a Monterey pine right here on the peninsula that fell during a windstorm. Local. And the trim around the room is redwood, old growth redwood. This trim was repurposed when we redid this zendo. It was what we call stringers across the top of a roof that holds shingles. So it was cleaned up and repurposed. We're in a forest and we don't even know it, you know. We're not paying attention to that way that time passes and objects change. So one of the ways we can settle ourselves when we are in this sense of unease is to kind of put ourselves in the bigger picture like that. This is not just a building, it's a forest over time. And after it's done being a building sometime in the future, we might say it'll be firewood. Then it'll have a different life. So if we can allow ourselves to see kind of a larger view, a sense of unease, it doesn't resolve itself in the moment, but it has kind of less grip. So now what I thought I was going to be talking about is this. I have been studying this teaching called the Metta Sutta. This is the teaching on loving kindness. And I've said it before, but I'll repeat it in its briefest way, the story of how this teaching came about. It's known to be one of the Buddha's early teachings. And the circumstance, as I've read it, there are multiple versions of this. I'll just give you one. The circumstance, as I've read it, is this. At some distance from where the Buddha was actually living at the time, a group of monks and nuns were living in a village. And they had decided to occupy the terrain of this village that was also serving as the graveyard of the people in that, of the ancestors of the people of that village. And so at some point, the people tried to complain to the disciples of the Buddha, you know, it's not really working for us that you're occupying the land on top of our ancestors. Would you move? And they said no. They stayed there. So apparently three times the villagers asked and three times the disciples said no. So the villagers were insistent. So they went to the Buddha or sent a representative to the Buddha and said, you know, please talk to your disciples because this is really not working for us. And so the Metta Sutta is what the Buddha taught. I'll recite a little bit of it so you get a little flavor. This is what should be accomplished by the one who is wise. If you know it, say it with me. Who seeks the good and has obtained peace. Let one be strenuous, upright, and sincere, without pride, easily contented, and joyous. Let one not be submerged by the things of the world. Let one not take upon oneself the burden of riches. Let one's senses be controlled. Let one be wise but not puffed up. And let one not desire great possessions even for one's family. Let one do nothing that is mean or that the wise would reprove. May all beings be happy. May they be joyous and live in safety. All living beings, whether weak or strong, in high or middle or low realms of existence, small or great, visible or invisible, near or far, born or to be born, may all beings be happy. Let no one deceive another, nor despise any being in any state. Let none bear anger or hatred which harm to another. Even as a mother, at the risk of her life, watches over and protects her only child, so with a boundless mind should one cherish all living things, suffusing love over the entire world, above, below, and all around without limit, so let one cultivate an infinite goodwill toward the whole world. Standing or walking, sitting or lying down, during all one's waking hours, let one practice the way with gratitude. Not holding to fixed views, endowed with insight, freed from sense appetites, one who achieves the way will be freed from the duality of birth and death. There are many messages inside that teaching, and I would highlight a couple of them as a way to guide us through this time that we are in. As I see it, those monks and nuns were enacting or exhibiting some kind of lack of awareness of their status. They held, I don't know, I wasn't there, I'm not inside their minds, I don't know exactly what they were doing. But if this is what I were observing today, I would say they held some kind of view of themselves as having a higher status. They didn't need to pay attention to what the villagers were talking about, you know? In contemporary language, we would call that privilege. They were enacting some level of privilege, consciously or unconsciously. So we've seen many times in the Buddha's teachings, for example, offering us, recently here we have recited the Buddha's Parinirvana Brief Admonitions Sutra. And it's brief because it's for us, it's one page front and back. And it's actually a very, very concentrated version of a text that's about this thick called the Mid-Length Discourses. So one page rather than 700-something pages all squished into one. And toward the end of this, it's when the Buddha is preparing to die, so he's giving his last teaching. And he says, I am like a good physician who has prescribed medicine. If the patient does not take the medicine, it's not the physician's fault. So the Buddha has offered us this medicine time and time again, and we see it and hear it, and then we often forget or turn away from it on purpose. So, other examples of the medicine that the Buddha has offered us, the antidote to greed, one of the toxic, in our practice we call it a poison, the antidote to greed, obvious to us, generosity. And yet, we don't, you know. We stay kind of enclosed in a self-centered view, and generosity entails broadening the view, opening the heart. Sometimes, consciously or unconsciously, we choose to stay closed with our ego-centered view. It's not that we shouldn't have an ego, we have them. And how we apply them and use them matters. All right, so another antidote that the Buddha has offered us is sometimes called hatred. But, you know, none of us really would say, I hate you, because either we wouldn't admit it or we don't actually feel it. But we do feel such a thing called aversion. We have a tendency to turn away from that which we don't like or that with which we don't have affinity. It's not exactly hatred, but it's somewhere on the continuum, you know, aversion to outright hatred. So the Buddha's antidote to this is the gift of Zazen, the capacity to examine the mind and heart that creates division. This is where aversion comes from. So, abandoning that, the Buddha's teaching about inclusivity, broadening our view, is the antidote to aversion. So we have greed, we have aversion, and we have ignorance, sometimes called delusion. And Zazen, of course, is related to this as well. Having a clear view and having a holistic view intervenes in our tendency towards ignorance. So, the Buddha many times offered us antidotes. So this teaching, called the Metta Sutta, the teaching on loving kindness, is really the antidote to the pain of consciously or unconsciously acting out privilege. So, I'd like to share a little bit of a different translation, because the language of this other translation is really quite rich. And someone went back to the Pali and Sanskrit versions of this teaching, the ancient teaching, and translated it literally line by line. And so it's a little bit awkward linguistically. It doesn't exactly flow like the one we just recited. But the choice of words is really poignant to me. So the first chunk that we recited, this is what should be accomplished by the one who is wise, who seeks the good and has obtained peace. Let one be strenuous, upright, and sincere, without pride, easily contented and joyous. Listen to this. This is what ought to be done by one skilled in the good, having understood the path to peace, able, straightforward and straight up, polite. They should be mild and not arrogant. This so clearly illustrates the possibility of were the nuns and monks who were occupying that graveyard, right? Polite, mild, not arrogant. In other words, listen to the villagers, they were telling you something, you know? And then grounded and not impulsive. Very strong, isn't it? This line, in the one that we recited, let one not take upon oneself the burden of riches. Here's how I understand that, and the literal translation really points at this sharply. The burden of riches, like, here's why it's burdensome. Many people, not necessarily those in this room, but many people chase after what the impression of their riches will give. You know, who's going to think what of me based on my car or my home or my clothing, right? I think it's pretty clear that many people, myself included, choose clothing based on with which groups do I have affinity, you know? Anyway, this burden of riches business has something to do with how we expect to be seen by the world. So the literal translation is this: grounded, not impulsive, and not chasing status. Isn't that clear? Yeah. A little bit later in the literal translation, and I'll refer it back to the one we recited. Let me find it first. Here we go. We said, let no one deceive another nor despise in any being in any state. Let none by anger or hatred wish harm to another. That's pretty clear. We would all quite easily want to abide by that. This one. Not humiliating or despising anyone anywhere. Though anger or experiencing repugnance, they should not wish suffering for another. So this tendency that we have in contemporary language, we have the word privilege. In contemporary language, we have the word othering. Not humiliating or despising anyone anywhere. That's a nice way of saying stop othering. Or another nice way of saying, check your microaggressions in contemporary language, right? Microaggressions come out in the subtlest ways. We may not even feel them as aggressive ourselves, but the recipient of that microaggression almost certainly felt it deeply. If you're interested, at some point, let me know and I'll post the website of this on the bulletin board, or I'll give it to Rachel to include in the resources. It's the literal translation, English literal translation of the Metta Sutta. It's very helpful to actually literally put them side by side and compare them line by line, or even better, sit with a buddy and have one person read a phrase out of the one we recite and another person read the literal translation phrase and stop and discuss the nuances of that languaging. It's really a very powerful exercise. The Buddha is supposed to have said something like this, that hearing and thinking about Buddhism is like standing outside the gate. So hearing and thinking about it is helpful, and that's not the whole picture. So hearing and thinking about Buddhism like standing outside the gate, but that Zazen itself is like returning home. Where I'm going by speaking that is that it's required to understand microaggression and othering at the cognitive level, to be aware that this is a social phenomenon based on what I would call social constructs. But understand that the intellectualizing level, but it's required that we drop it into the body. And Zazen is actually the training ground for doing that very thing. If we only hear and think about it, opinions prevail. I don't think I need to explain that much. But in opinions, confusion dominates. You know, we don't ever find our ground when opinions are flying in every direction. And that's truly like standing outside the gate. But in Zazen, all phenomenal things... The first word that came to mind was disappear, but that's not exactly right. But phenomenal things at least momentarily dissipate or lose their solidity, or we recognize them as transient during Zazen. And Zazen itself is not conditioned by place or by time or even by the conditions of my personal life. So it's like returning home to the common home that we collectively hold throughout space and time. So ignorance comes from not knowing the self, not knowing this individual one, and also not knowing the condition of being human. And Zazen is what allows us to meet and not turn away from that self. So, one of the ancients said it this way: when delusions disappear, calmness emerges. When calmness emerges, wisdom arises. When wisdom arises, there is true understanding. And that one goes on to then imply, out of true understanding, appropriate response arises naturally. Because it's inclusive, necessarily, you know? It's really kind of that simple. So Zazen itself is the training ground for that sequence. And in order to kind of allow ignorance to fall away, what's required is that we have to stop thinking, maybe, just enough, or stop thinking comparatively, good and evil, right and wrong, better and worse, higher status, lower status. We let go of that level of critical thinking and be with what is rather than a construct of what is. When this divisive way of thinking and feeling dissipates, delusion or ignorance also dissipates. So this is a paraphrase then of what the elder said. I'll quote it again. When delusions disappear, calmness emerges. When calmness emerges, wisdom arises. When wisdom arises, there is true understanding. And then by implication, appropriate action. So when delusive thoughts dissipate, is a way to say it, there emerges the reality that allows us to see clearly into things as they are. Or Suzuki Roshi said it, things as it is. And for a long time, people thought that he made a grammatical error, with English being his second language, things as it is. But it became more and more clear that he actually intended to take the plural and make it a singular. You know? So, language-wise, flow a little bit easier to say things as they are, but worth considering things as it is. So this clear insight is not passive. I would also say, actually, that it's not active in the way that we have activity with a goal in mind. it is active in that it is a response to the existing circumstances. Mm-hmm. So when we can free ourselves from that kind of divisive thinking, we're free to respond completely in the present moment. So I'm going to give you homework. You know, I'm a retired school teacher. I have to give homework. This is the way it works. I'll encourage you over the next month or so to examine, engage this practice. I am aware or I am unaware in this activity that I have expressed a different status, or I have expressed a division of some kind. And very specifically, upon greeting someone, what is your habit? Just watch. There's no better or worse about this. Just watch. Is it inclusive? Is it welcoming? Any greeting? Elbow bumps more than handshakes these days, but still. And if you are an individual who is accustomed to being forthright, kind of, the word that comes to mind is dominant. I don't mean it that way, but forthright and strong. Consider letting the other person set the pace of this particular greeting. Watch and see what happens. You know, or in a meeting, we have plenty of meetings here. Your meeting participation. If you are someone who frequently speaks your mind clearly and quickly, what would happen if you didn't? What might emerge in that group? This is not an admonition to not speak, but allow something other than the habitual to occur. That's the invitation. Mm-hmm. Just like in Zazen, allowing something other than the habitual to occur. Where I personally notice this examination, where I'm mostly unaware, is driving. You know, I'm very critical of other drivers. Yeah. And I'm absolutely arrogant about driving. Yeah. So look and see where the Metta Sutta will teach you something about driving or greeting or participating in meetings, particularly this able, straightforward, straight up, polite, mild, and not arrogant. Try it out. And that's not to say that there isn't a time to say no, absolutely not, and set a firm boundary. It's totally appropriate exactly some of the times, and not necessarily all of the time. I've been reading this amazing book by Zenju Earthling Manual, a priest who trained at San Francisco Zen Center and whose teacher was Blanche Hartman. And her book, The Way of Tenderness, one of her books, I should say, The Way of Tenderness, and the subtitle, Awakening Through Race, Sexuality, and Gender. So she really gives us a way to examine our habitual and with a strong encouragement to welcome and include difference. So I'll quote from her for just a moment. She's exploring the awakening to the challenge of embodiment through two states of being. One of those states of being multiplicity in oneness. So this is a little bit like things as it is. Huh? Multiplicity in oneness. And the body itself as nature. Multiplicity in oneness indicates an awareness that oneness includes difference. And the body in nature indicates an awareness that the body itself is an inherited form of nature. So this places us squarely in our animal bodies, you know, with each other and our social constructs finding their way. These two also indicate that identity exists and that there is a natural identity that exists alongside contingent socio-political and emotional ones. I'll read that again. It's a very, very concentrated sentence. These two also indicate that identity exists and that there is a natural identity that exists alongside contingent socio-political and emotional ones. So this is an invitation to examine our social constructs. And in her book, Race, Sexuality, and Gender, in your life, it could be politics, environment, hygiene, it could be anything, you know, a chance to examine. So please let your Zazen train you. Zazen is useless. You know, there's a whole teaching about Zazen being like play, like music or creating art, just play for the sake of play. Zazen for the sake of Zazen. It's useless in that same way, except that it trains us for life outside the Zendo. When we can, what we've been calling in our Foundations class, when we can catch that micro movement, the pivotal moment when things would habitually or reactively turn divisive, we can catch it and go, okay, what is my appropriate response here that's actually consistent with my vow? Let one be strenuous, upright, and sincere, without pride, easily contented and joyous. Maybe you have questions or comments. We have a few minutes. Richard. Let's see, what did they say? Calmness, wisdom, and true understanding. That's how that elder said it.
So for me, we're maybe the best way to put it is that I get lost or I drop off. Is it calmness? Mm. Because I don't know what wisdom and true understanding are, and I don't think in this lifetime I will. In other words, I'm saying letting go and calmness might be a place responding from.
Yeah. Actually, I think none of us knows what wisdom and understanding is in a cognitive way. But we know it in our bodies when we feel it. Yeah. There's no way I can put words on what this is called true understanding. There's no way I can put words on it. And I sit here month after month flapping my lips, trying to express something, but to put words on it is absolutely useless. Yeah. But we know it when we feel it.
Yeah, I accept that.
Yeah.
Good.
Thank you, Richard. Yes, Sarah.
When Richard was speaking, it made me think of an example. So we're talking about when that point comes, when you start to feel the division, when you learn how to be skillful and like with driving, when I notice it, I'll think, you know, next time I'm not going to park here. I'm going to drive a little bit farther and I'll just park somewhere where I will maybe have to deal with the same situation, you know, or I won't turn down that one street. I'll just go a different way and maybe park over here so that I won't, you know, have to, maybe that situation won't happen again. Those are examples. And then in terms of calmness leading to wisdom and understanding, I feel like after we go through a sesshin, or for me, after practicing yoga, you feel very calm. And when you're driving home, if somebody runs a stoplight sign or something, you don't really feel anger because you're very calm. But if you're in a different mindset where maybe you're thinking, I have to get over to this class or whatever, then at that point you might feel anger towards someone.
Right, right. And it is exactly circumstantial. Yeah. For me, after Sesshin, it's the best time to clean a house. Because I notice every little speck of dust that otherwise I don't see. Yeah, there's something about Sesshin mind being totally settled, absolutely. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
Was it saying anything about consistency?
Consistency?
And just...
In the two things that I have brought forward, it does not. But here's what I know myself about consistency, maybe something to respond to. And then you'll look and see how it works for you. I know for me, having a daily zazen practice, I would call this an example of consistency, helps me because it's body-based. So the period of time before I come to the zendo, my body is already anticipating settling down. So then I settle down, and then upon leaving, that settled carries with me. And generally, until the next time I'm getting ready to sit zazen, I'm already preparing for the next period of zazen, settle down, and then that carries on through the rest of the evening. So there is something for the animal body about consistency, time-wise, because it's a natural cycle. As natural as the sun rising and setting. You'll have to look for yourself and see if that's true. Yes?
You're talking about actively or mindfully breaking habits, and the way I would maybe put it is putting yourself outside of your comfort zone. And but you bring up and mention that some habitual action can be beneficial for both the for your body and mind. And I switched to trying to do morning meditation for a bit, but I realized that through my whole schedule out of the rest of my life off, and while I appreciated it, I understood that maybe at where I am right now, it's not the most conducive to living in what I would say is like naturally occurring. So how do we know when sometimes our comfort zones limit us from maybe exploring other ways of living?
Yeah, I gotcha. Whatever the schedule is, it has to work in your life. You know, work life, family life, school life, whatever that is, it has to fit so that it's not draining. We want the experience of returning to Zendo to be nourishing and encouraging. So if it's having the effect of discouragement or fatigue, it's not fulfilling its function. That's one of the ways to feel it. And I think there is something about this habitual that's kind of an open area of exploration for me, so this might be a little vague. Let's see how it goes. There are routines here in the Zendo that I and other priests perform in a supposedly a very precise way. There, it's, you know, step onto the mat with the right foot, step off of the mat with the right foot. It's very prescribed. So there is that level of the habitual that is, do it this way and don't question it. And then there is this other level of, oh, that was yesterday's person, this is today's person. How is today's person going to step on the mat with the right foot? So like there's some freshness to the habit, even though it's the same thing, it's actually totally different. You know? Yeah. So, for you, picking a schedule to sit in the community that works for you is a question of physical and mental health, I would guess. Yeah. We don't want to put the functioning of your physical and mental health at risk. Yeah. So, yeah, it has to work in your life. And then, when something is habitual and perhaps boringly habitual, what freshness can one bring to it? And then it's not habit anymore. Anyway, exploring. Don't know for sure. Yes, Corrine, and then we'll stop.
Oh, it must be a few years ago I was reading the newsletter, the Sangha newsletter, and it was reviewing maybe a talk by Catherine, or maybe, I don't quite remember, maybe she was writing that, but it was exactly about driving. And she copped to the fact that she had been looking for, I guess, being kind of an aggressive driver, and looking for a spot to, you know, move forward, and then it caught up with her. And taking a look at that, or many looks at that, she decided she would approach it with, what do people need?
What do people need?
What do people need? What do these drivers need?
Yes.
And so, I mean, you can feel the difference right there. It's like, whew, here we all are.
Yes.
And here is my vow, and how can I, execute the vow in this situation.
Yes.
And I kind of adopted that.
Uh-huh.
When I drive, I'm not an aggressive driver, but it just feels so much better as I'm observing what other people are doing.
Yes.
Well, what do people need? And it makes it a lot easier and simpler and present with them, and instead of having a negative thought about it, well, I don't need to impose a lot on it. I'm imposing something more positive.
Got it. So that's an example of the Buddha's antidote to aversion, which we would call inclusivity. What is needed here? It's similar in response. What is needed here related to a Zazen schedule? What is needed related to driving?
Yeah.
Common courtesy on the road. I'll offer you, before ending here, another Catherine story, speaking of her driving. She spoke of this as an awakening moment, actually, in which she had been driving fairly aggressively and someone followed her into the gas station where she stopped. And he got out of his car and was standing at her driver's side window, mad because she had kind of cut him off. What were you thinking? And she said she woke up. She had been eating gummy worms and driving at the same time. What were you thinking?
That's fair enough.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, Catherine. I miss her. Great question, you know. What is needed here? That just the second that it would take to pause and ask that tips us toward inclusivity and turns us away from ignoring. Very good. Thank you very much for engaging the topic.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow.